Αγνή Παρθένε Δέσποινα, αχράντε Θεοτόκε.
Welcome to the Loins of History, a podcast that connects history to current events. We are dedicated to correcting political and historical illiteracy. My name is Jay, and I'm joined this week by my co-host, Colin. And this is our third and final episode in our little mini-series on the fall of Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire. We're in a much larger series. This is what, like episode 8 or 9?
Nine. This is episode 9 now.
In our season on fall of empires or fall of civilizations. Last week, Colin gave us a really good episode about the siege of Constantinople in 1453. And this week, I think we're going to talk about some of the effects of that and how it relates to today. So, Colin, what do you got for us this week?
Well, I hope everyone's had a chance to emotionally recover after last week, because truly a tragic event.
Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Tragic event, but really a monumental event in history. And we don't say that. We don't use that term lightly. So, yeah, for today's episode, what we're going to do is we're going to start off talking and kind of comparing and contrasting the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And if you remember on our very first couple episodes where we talked about some of the reasons that the Western Roman Empire fell, we're going to compare those to the Eastern Roman Empire and why they fell, spot some differences and discuss those. And then we're going to really shift into the fallout and what the fall of Constantinople led to, because it really was a shift in power dynamics, geopolitical power dynamics, in art and history and religion across the world. So it's a very exciting episode. I'll start off with ways it was similar. And I just wanted to bring this up because Jay and I like to connect points of history. So connecting the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire to the Western one, I just thought made a lot of sense. And especially because we spent two episodes talking about it, it would be good to go back and kind of throw these all together. So if you remember, we had three episodes with Rome about the economy, culture, and the loss of virtue, and then the military. Those were really three big drivers. There's many more, but I did want to make a point that for the Eastern Roman Empire, they had some similarities and some differences. The differences being virtue and culture. Gibbon contends that much of the Eastern Roman Empire had lost its valor and its connection to Rome, true Roman virtue being the agrarian, you know, peasant soldier, farmer soldier, I should say, the martial vigor. Those days had long passed, and that they were really passive and cared more about extravagance in themselves. And I would disagree with that. There's a lot of evidence to point to some extravagance with Constantinople and the East being fairly wealthy in comparison to many Western countries and nations at the time. So any of those Western nations visiting Constantinople and seeing it, it probably appeared as though they were extravagant and decadent and not nearly as brave. Just they didn't have quite the virtue that they did. Now, a lot of that, I want to point out, is probably driven, first off, by a religious animosity between the Orthodox and the Latins, some military and geopolitical animosity. If you remember, the Latins sacked Constantinople in 1204. There was also some running conflict before then as well. So a lot of that has probably been overblown. Not to say that there wasn't decadence, there wasn't bribery, there wasn't some corruption, but it didn't happen at the scale that Rome went through. You know, the Romans were known for being virtuous in the early Republic, early Imperial Rome, and then they went to people that just didn't care about fighting. They had no sense of honor. They were corrupt, not just their leaders, but everyone down to the bottom throughout the entire empire. And that was one of the main drivers. Not so much in Constantinople. I think the biggest ones and where it was similar was the military losses. You could almost have a direct, I mean, Manzikert and Adrianople were so similar in the fact that you had two empires kind of on decline, and then you had this unexpected disaster. And even though Adrianople happened about 100 years before the fall of the Western Roman Empire, Manzikert happened 400 years before Constantinople fell. It was almost like the writing was on the wall because they just couldn't muster enough forces to stop the onslaught at that point. And they had to call for help and bring in others to come and fight for them, just unable to hold the tide back. And so they just continued on the east to suffer military defeat after military defeat. And we kind of talked about it last week with the Ottomans just slowly pushing their way all the way to the Mediterranean into taking over Anatolia and then Thrace. So, you know, that did occur. Now, they continued to fight. You know, they had some elite troopers, the cataphracts, the Varangian Guard. So they had a lot of elite troops and they did fight and they did still win victories. It's just the tide had turned, similar to Adrianople.
Yeah. So thinking about Rome and why it collapsed, because we talked about how the opulence just led to, like you said, this degradation of virtue. Opulence, like even though, yes, the Byzantines and Constantinople, like they were rich and they had money, but did, this is less of, I'm making a statement with a question. Opulence didn't really play a major role in their downfall, right?
No.
Like no one looks back. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I would contend that Rome, because it was almost like Rome just stopped caring about building and defending themselves. They were in a position where had they just maintained some of the continuous virtue that they displayed in centuries past, they might have been able to weather the storm. With the Byzantine Empire, you look at it and you think, well, there was no time for just the average peasant to live a life of opulence and corruption. They just couldn't do it because they were under constant threat. It just didn't occur the same way. There wasn't a breakdown in society the same way there was in Rome. Now, Gibbon makes some serious accusations in his book of just they didn't even want to fight, and basically the women would do all the fighting before some of the men. And you know, it was written in the 18th century, so that was probably a big insult. But I just look at it and I think it wasn't a contributing factor. There was nothing that made them more decadent or opulent or corrupt compared to other nations that had similar amounts of wealth. It was probably crusaders who came from very poor areas in developing areas within Europe and saw that, and they assumed decadent, corrupt. And it didn't help that they did utilize a lot of mercenaries. So the Varangian Guard was made up of Scandinavian Vikings, Norsemen, and Saxon warriors. So they were foreigners and they were paid handsomely. So they probably didn't like the fact that they had foreigners fighting for them. That is the Westerners. To me, it doesn't strike me as a reason that they started to collapse. Like the collapse was already beginning with some of these military losses. Now, they did have some bad leaders. Similar to the Western Roman Empire, they did have some bad leaders that made very bad decisions, and they had some dynastic changes and power shifts that put them in a position at critical junctures of history where they were not set up to deal with the threat appropriately. After Justinian the Great died, within a couple decades, they had lost the Holy Land, Egypt, parts of North Africa. And they were on the retreat, and Constantinople was under siege a few years later, twice, as a matter of fact, within like a century or two. So it just goes to show that they weren't really prepared because they had been fighting other people. They had been fighting themselves over, you know, and I mean, they talking about like these dynasties within the Byzantine Empire. But, you know, another thing to consider with the Byzantine Empire, they... Similar to late stage Rome, and this is kind of, if you've ever heard the History of Rome podcast by
Mike Duncan.
Mike Duncan, he makes a big point about the Goths not being assimilated into Rome, and that's one of his theories that it's a driving factor. Well, kind of similar in the Byzantine Empire, where there was a lot of religious pressure. So within Anatolia, you had a huge Muslim population, you had a huge Christian population, you had some Jewish and other tribal religions, and they were pretty oppressed by the Byzantines. So there was a lot of this unrest that they were dealing with that they never really quite integrated into their society fully. So it was very easy for invading Seljuk Turks and the Ottomans later to find recruits to go and fight the Byzantines, because they could basically say, hey, we're going to treat you better. You're not going to have to live under the infidel anymore. You can come fight for us. and they were very eager to do it. So they just never really managed their internal religious strife. And then externally, they didn't do a very good job either, because they alienated the ones that could actually help them. So it was a geopolitical snafu where they didn't assimilate internally, and then they ostracized externally.
Yeah. See, we haven't talked too much about the dynamics in the Ottoman Empire, right? Like, you talked about their military and their military capabilities, but like, the Ottomans were actually pretty, they embraced a fairly high level of religious freedom, especially when they started taking over the Balkans. Like, they were not like demanding everyone convert to Islam. They just, you know, made them pay the jizya? Is that the name of the tax, right? It's like, you don't have to convert. You pay the tax, the jizya, and you're good. Like, and the Ottomans were that way for a long time. So to your point, like, there were the Ottomans, I don't know about specifically in Constantinople, but later they would employ Christians to
a lot of the Janissaries assist them. Were Christians.
Right. And it's like that, to your point, that the Byzantines were not able to reconcile that religious conflict internally, whereas the Ottomans, like, they were fairly, like, they allowed a fairly high level of religious freedom.
Dare I say, and tolerant?
Right. Yeah. Now, of course, there are exceptions to that rule. Like, you know, later the Ottomans conducted a genocide of, what was that? It was either during or right before World War I.
Oh, the Armenians.
Armenians, that's right. And I think religion, I mean, I think that was primarily ethnically driven, but I think religion was part of it. Anyway, so it's not, I'm not trying to like lift up Ottomans as like the shining example of religious freedom, but relatively speaking, compared to the Byzantines, maybe that was the case.
Yeah. And, you know, another couple other points on this economy. We talked about, like, that was a big deal for Rome, like that decimated their capabilities to withstand the onslaughts. The Byzantines were fairly wealthy. Right up until the end, they were fairly wealthy. Now, once they were on the chokehold, and, you know, when Constantine the 11th came to power, it was just a couple villages surrounded by walls, essentially. But for several hundred years before that, even after the Latins came there, they had some wealth because it was on a pivotal trade route. So, and this is, we're going to bring this up again in just a little bit, but that trade allowed them to flourish financially. So they could afford mercenaries. They could afford to buy armies and actually utilize money for diplomacy. So they bought a lot of Arabic, Saracen, Turkish armies off and kind of paid them to leave if necessary. And they would also do that to other European powers in Bulgaria and the Balkans and that whole area. They would do the same. So they had quite a bit of money. So that wasn't really a factor for them, where they just couldn't afford to survive. So that, you know, some similarities and some differences, you know, the military, they definitely started getting crushed the same way under the weight of just a seemingly unending onslaught. But as far as virtue and the economy, you know, religion and culture, I think, had something to do with it and the failure to assimilate. But, you know, you can just see some similarities and differences. And it's interesting. I think the reason I wanted to start with this is we should remember these as we go into other series when we talk in the future, and we kind of wrap it all up into today. So it's kind of like indicators and warnings that you can say, okay, well, I'm starting to see this happening today, or I see this happening with this empire. Wow, that's really similar. That's an interesting point we should take out.
You know, as I'm thinking about, like, excuse me, what caused the Byzantine Empire to collapse? Like, what led to 1453? I never in a million years thought that I would Beyonce in this podcast.
Never a bad time.
But here we are, Colin. Here's Beyonce. The reality is, sometimes you lose. And you're never too good to lose. You're never too big to lose. You're never too smart to lose. It happens.
Wow.
And profound. That quote popped in my head, like, thinking about, like, you know what? There's truth there. And I think there's... that is applicable to the Byzantines. I'm saying this out loud. I can't believe I'm saying this out loud. Where Beyonce can speak on the Byzantines here.
We should invite her to the podcast next time. See if she'll, be a guest speaker.
I'm sure she's got some great historical insights. But it's like, it really, I think there's an element of truth in saying that the Byzantines just lost. Like, and they lost over and over again over several hundred years. And it was like, you can do the best you can, but like, you know, sometimes you just lose.
They had kind of the two steps back, one step forward. That was kind of their decline. Be like, okay, yeah. Well, we just got our butts handed to us. Well, we just won back a little territory. Well, we just got our butts handed to us again. Well, we won back a little bit. And yeah. It was just constant for 800 years.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, historians like to ask the question, like, could it have happened any differently? Or was it inevitable, right? Like, it's because history is set, right? Like, what happened in the past happened in the past. You can't change it. It's super tempting.
That's a Lion King quote. It's in the past. Really? Yeah. I have a couple kids, so of course I've seen Lion King several times. It's in the past. You got to put your kids are not behind you.
Old enough for that. It's in the past. Yeah. Well, like, the fact that you can't alter the past, right? And it's because of that, it's tempting to look back on the past and think like, oh, what happened was inevitable. But the reality is like, okay, maybe, you know, there's not a entity on the face of this planet that has been around since the beginning of time, right? Like, therefore, it's like, it's safe to assume that a civilization, a state, a nation, like, it's going to eventually go away. So in that sense, it is inevitable. But I don't think we should look at the fall of the Byzantine Empire and say to ourselves, like, oh, 1453, it was going to happen in the way that it did happen. I think there were multiple opportunities for the Byzantines to turn it around. There is like, what's the legal phrase? It's like acts of chance or acts of God, like
force measure.
Yeah. It's like, sometimes like you just can't explain it. And it's just like, there's a higher power going on here that either chance or God, that just, you know, tells you, or gets to say like, nope, we're going to go this way no matter what you do. And that seems like, I don't know, like, I feel the tension there when looking back at the Byzantines to kind of go, where could it have gone differently? Or was it always going to play out like this?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because talking about like acts of God or force majeure, and I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm not a lawyer, but like, they actually had several of those that saved them. So that, in the past, right? So in the second siege of Constantinople in 718 AD, they used Greek fire to fight off the, I think at that point it was the Umayyads, and they set fire to their ships, and they absolutely decimated the Umayyads' navy. Like, they burned hundreds and hundreds of ships. Like, there's scenes describing the boat, like the burned boats with like the dead soldiers, like washing up against the seawalls. And there was just like this pitiful sight again, because it was just like a helpless sight of these Umayyad invaders just on fire, brushing up against the walls, helpless. And then they just crashed and disintegrated into the ocean. And then it broke the Umayyad Navy for hundreds of years. Like, they were no longer a threat to the city or that area of the Mediterranean. So there were, and I say Greek fire is like an act of God, because we don't know how to make it. We can't recreate it. And it was so devastating. Like, it saved the city from overwhelming odds. Like, there was hundreds of ships coming to attack Constantinople in that invasion.
You know, sometimes one of my favorite analogies is chess. And one of the things that they teach you in chess is you have to play the board that's in front of you. You cannot play the board that you want to play. And sometimes when you're just facing a better opponent, like, you have to accept the reality for what it is, right? And I think maybe the Byzantines, you know, you look back at their long decline and you see like, hey, sometimes they got lucky, right? Sometimes they were the better entity, right? Like they invented Greek fire and they did their thing, right? And sometimes, like, you can't go for gold when you're not in a position to win gold. You just got to, like, cut your losses, live to fight another day, try to, you know, do the best you can. I say all that to say because I'm thinking about, like, okay, what lessons learned are there for how can we in the West today avoid a similar fate to Constantinople? And I think one of them is, you know, sometimes, like, for whatever reason, things outside of our control, things that, you know, these acts of God or something else, you just got to, like, cut your losses. You got to go, hey, today, this year, this decade, not a good one. But we're going to, you know, like, we're going to learn our lessons, we're going to cut our losses, and we're going to live to fight another day. And, you know, we're going to weather the storm, etc. What if, is that, do you feel like that's a good lesson?
100% agree. Yeah, it's not so much that you have to constantly, it's almost like you have to be constantly thinking about self-preservation. Even if you are in one of the most strategic cities in the world, you're one of the wealthiest cities and empires, you have a great army, a secret weapon on your navy, you have allies to the west and potentially some to the east. You have to have long vision. You have to see hundreds of years in the future, generations. You have to think generationally. And I don't think they did a very good job of that, thinking generationally, where they would be if they don't fortify Anatolia. Where are they going to be if they don't maintain naval dominance in the Mediterranean? Where are they going to be if they allow Ottoman raiders into Thrace? You know what I mean? Where are they going to be if they continue to allow, like, they were so short-sighted. Up until, like, December of 1452, they were debating on whether or not that they should try and make amends with the Western Latin Church and the Pope. Like, they were so prideful and arrogant, they didn't want to do it. Even though that was really, in reality, like, at that point, kind of one of the few things that might have been able to save them was, like, an army being sent over from the Pope, or the Pope, you know, telling Western nations to send troops to reinforce. Like, they still, up until December, and heck, maybe had they been able to do it 6 months prior with kind of a happy heart, the Pope might have had more sway and been able to send more Venetian and Genoan ships with more mercenaries. Maybe, you know, some German states decide to get involved. The Hungarians come to the, who knows?
Yeah.
My point in saying that is they were extremely myopic and short-sighted up until the end.
Interesting.
And we cannot do that, where we think, you can't think, and if you're going to put your shoes in America, because most of our listeners are American and we are American, so not that hard to do. Mm-hmm. We tend to think via, you know, through election cycles. Hey, what is this going to do the next 2 years? Now, you finish one election, and then it's 2 weeks later, and all of a sudden we're starting to talk midterms, general election, primaries. It's nonstop, and that's all you think about, rather than thinking like, well, hey, if we do X, Y, what is going to happen to X in 10 years? We just don't do it. And I think that's a huge, huge, huge blunder on our part.
Yeah. No, I agree, man. And I think, when you're so short-sighted, you lose sight of the big picture vision for why you even exist in the first place. You know, thinking about, like, you know, maybe a counter argument to my own earlier point here is that, like, okay, self-preservation, like, yeah, there may come a time when you have to play the chessboard that's in front of you and not the one that you want to play. But in another sense, like, big picture, it's kind of like, when you just focus on not losing, you're going to lose. Like, you got to think about how to win. And when you're, to your point, when you're so short-sighted and you're just thinking about, like, okay, how do I win tomorrow? You're not actually thinking about the big picture, which is just another form of self-preservation, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. And not to belabor it, but I think most Byzantine rulers, and They did not. They thought they were very myopic. There were instances where they did, like after Manzikert, I think it was Alexander Comnenus. You know, he wrote a letter to the Pope, basically being like, "Hey, we are in trouble. Your Christian brothers in the East." And that was one, you know, that's kind of one thing where he's like, "All right, how do we win?" And his thought was like, "Okay, I can get the Crusaders to come and take care of an enemy from me. I'll just walk in behind them into Anatolia. I'll retake all my old territory, you know." But then as soon as he did that, it's like they completely dropped the ball as far as how they handled the Latin Crusaders and kind of like the step two. It's like, okay, well, we took it back and now we're sitting in a good spot because we have this huge buffer out in front of us. What do we do? And they, you know, they just fumbled it and ended up getting sacked in 1204.
Yeah. A word that we've brought up several times since the beginning of the series is inertia, right? And it's kind of like, it still feels like when looking at the Byzantines, there was just this inertia of like, no matter what they did, nobody actually believed they were going to ever reconquer Anatolia, right? But because people believed that, like, it's almost like, what's the saying? It's like, oh, we can't do it. And it's like, you're right. Not with that attitude. It's like, look at it, you know, the Byzantines and be like, oh, we're never going to be able to reconquer it. It's like, yeah, not with that attitude.
So Jay, with that being said, I do want to move on and discuss like the fallout of what happened.
Yeah.
And I think the term inertia is a great way to put it, because historical events and these massive changes in epochs, they don't occur necessarily on a fall of Constantinople type of thing. We like to look to that as historians, and the way our brains work, it's great to put a spot on a line and say, this is where it happened. It helps us organize. But the reality is, a lot of the things that we're going to talk about of the fallout were already in motion. And then the fall of Constantinople, like, threw gas on the fire. That's kind of the way I would look at it and say, like, okay, we had these things going. It was, you know, we had some small kindling and a little light and a few embers, and we just threw gas on it. And so the first one of those is the Ottoman Empire truly becoming a power, not just in the Middle East, but a world power. It's kind of like a welcoming party, like a Sweet 16 for the Ottoman Empire, like a debutante ball. Like, and they, when they took Constantinople, and I say that kind of tongue in cheek as a silly analogy, but the reality is, Mehmed II was already courting European powers, but they didn't take the threat to Constantinople seriously. And if you remember the quote,
right,
he had peace on the lips, but war in his heart. Mm-hmm. When he took Constantinople, it forced the courts in Europe to take him seriously, because he just sacked the second Rome. He was now, and he was calling himself Caesar in Turkish. He was now a serious threat. And the Ottoman Empire from this point, because they became a power, continued to expand. They took over the rest of Greece. They sacked the despot of Epirus. They took over Trebizond on the Anatolian peninsula on the north side. They expanded into Egypt, parts of North Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, into Mesopotamia and Persia. They became an empire, a true empire. And actually in 1517, they became the caliphate. They were the caliphate until 1924, when Ataturk declared it a secular state. But the point of saying that is, when they took Constantinople, it was a moment that everyone had to take note. Now they had to deal with a serious power, right? It's kind of like when Rome fell, everyone had to turn around and look and see, wow, Rome has fallen. Who do we look to now? Now they were looking to the Ottomans.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think we discussed this either before or after we recorded our last episode, but like, one of the more tragic things, well, tragic from maybe a Western standpoint, view on the fall of Constantinople, is that like Italy today is like, Rome's still there, right? Like, and we call it Rome, like, and they, well, Italians call it Roma, but you know, like, and it's still like the Pope's still there, and you know, there's,
you know, churches, Catholics,
the churches are still there, right? There's Western culture is alive and well on the Italian peninsula. It's not in Istanbul. And like, we, the West, never got that back. Now, we have since learned, and the Turks have since learned to play nice, for the most part, with one another. And, you know, they're a part of NATO. Pretty sure they're a part of the EU. Like, you know, there's, I'm not saying that we should treat modern day Turks in an adversarial way. That's not true at all. But in terms of like Western culture, it's not there. The Hagia Sophia is a mosque. And no reason to believe it will ever get back. You know, there were talks when the Greeks declared independence like a 100 years ago. There were talks that the Greeks wanted to take, you know, back over, but that obviously never happened. And today there's still a lot of rhetoric between the Greeks and the Turks. But like there's that tragic aspect that today we are still feeling the effects of what the Ottomans did. Like the Ottoman Empire is gone, but like you said, this, you know, this coming of age tale, this like debutante ball, like this, like, you know, world history has never been the same after the fall of Constantinople. And it's like that, like that taking of that one city was such a tectonic shift in world events that even today, like, we're still feeling the effects of that kind of thing. When the Ottoman Empire, like you said, like they became a huge empire that like probably quadrupled, if not more than that, in size in the centuries that followed. Was it not quite 400 years the Ottoman Empire continued to grow?
I mean, up until really about World War I, but the peak of the Ottoman, well, so let's back up a second. You said something, you know, should we play nice with the Turks and treat? Yeah, now we do. They're part of NATO, but immediately after this, like, the West was in a bad spot. So if you think of the Mediterranean strategically, at this point in 1453, you still had remnants of the Umayyads in what was now called the Cordoba Caliphate in southern Spain. You had North Africa was the Barbary States, different Tripoli and a few others. You had Egypt, which was hostile. You had the remnants of the Holy Land, which was no longer Crusader States. And the Ottomans had taken over all of that. So the entire Mediterranean was no longer safe for Western nations to do trade and travel along. So, like, strategically speaking, the Eastern Mediterranean, for all intents and purposes, was like in enemy territory. From, you know, you could draw a line like Greece down in the Adriatic. That was kind of a dividing line. And the Adriatic is, that's a short hop right into Italy in the heart of Western civilization. So, you know, and then you have on land, the Ottomans decided, well, we've taken Constantinople. We're going to push north, and actually got as far as Vienna twice. So they laid siege to Vienna twice. And one of the most epic cavalry charges occurred at the Second Battle of Vienna with King Jan from Poland leading his hussars to charge.
The winged hussars.
Yeah, it was like the largest cavalry charge in history. But, you know, really up until that second siege of Vienna, the Ottoman Empire was growing and not menace makes it seem like they're Dennis the Menace shooting, you know, spitballs at him. Like, they were an existential threat to a lot of countries in the East and Western, you know, like France, Germany. They were having to pay attention now because Hungary is being attacked. Rome, you know, all these other the Balkan nations were now.
Serbia, Bosnia, Albania, taken over.
The former Yugoslavia, that's probably the easiest way to say it. The former Yugoslavia, for the most part, they were subjugated now as under Ottoman suzerainty. So my point in saying all that is for the next 200-ish years, the Ottomans were an existential threat to most of Europe, actually. And they were a terrifying, you know, the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, there were certain key events. I think you mentioned one a few weeks ago, the Siege of Malta, where the remnant of the Knights Hospitaller had fought them off. There was the Battle of Lepanto where some Venetian and Spanish ships defeated a much larger Ottoman navy. But you had these, and then obviously the battles of Vienna. So you had these moments where they started stemming the tide, but there was still about 200 years where the Ottomans were the force in the Mediterranean world. Now, that's going to lead me into the second point of fallout with the way to think of the Ottomans as kind of this hostile new power now encroaching on Western nations. It's not that trade ended between them. As a matter of fact, the Ottomans tried to open up trade, and they had bazaars, they had ports. But, I mean, you remember from last week's episode with the throat cutter, the Venetian ship didn't want to pay the toll, and it got blown up, and everybody got beheaded that survived. So it's not like Westerners didn't want to go pay these extra taxes to someone else who controlled what was once, you know, a Christian empire. So they viewed it as them having to pay an enemy. So they wanted, but they still wanted these Eastern goods. And by Eastern, I mean like Chinese, Indian spices, you know, Chinese silk, Indian spices that they got a taste for, especially in the Crusades. And now that was gone, that had been taken from them. So they wanted to find a way that they could get back to it. And so like, if we think of a kind of what's happening in Europe right now, well, the Spanish are completing the Reconquista. So that began shortly after the Umayyads had invaded southern Italy or southern Spain and defeated the Visigoths. If you remember from Rome, they had moved into Spain. They had taken them over, pushed them all the way into Spain and the very, or all the way into France and then the very north tip of Spain. And over the previous 700 years, the Spanish had pushed them back and were completing that Reconquista. But suddenly now that they're becoming a power, both Spain and Portugal saw an opportunity to find alternate trade routes. So they're now regaining sovereignty of their territory. They have access to the ocean. And at this point, most people at this point don't believe the world is flat. They believed it was a globe. They didn't know how big the globe was, but they knew there had to be a way to get to India, had to be a way to get over there. And at this, as far as they knew, they were the furthest point west.
Right.
So why not build a ship and go explore? So they started, you know, immediately after Constantinople, it's shut off. We got to find an alternate. So we're going to start finding and sending out these ships. And that's when in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella commissioned Christopher Columbus to go sail the ocean blue. We know the rest of that story. But more importantly, if you look at Spain and Portugal, there was a treaty in, I think, the early 17th century. I'll have to look it up real quick because I don't have it off the top of my head. I'm thinking through this right now. They actually split the world. They were like, okay, well, we've discovered North and South America. Like, hey, we're the only two out here doing this. We're going to split it. So you take this part of the world, I'll take this part of the world. Because they were not only finding North and South America, but they had circumnavigated around Africa and the Cape of Good Hope. And they were finding all these other different islands and ways that they could get to India. So it kicked off the age of exploration. So there was this desire for trade. Did you find it?
Yeah, the 1494 Treaty of Tordesillas.
Okay, I was off by over 100 years, but yeah. So, but you can see they kicked off the age of exploration. So now you had monarchs in Europe funding these explorers to go off and find new lands for them. So the expansion no longer was, hey, I'm going to expand within Europe and try to fight over these couple square miles. I can go overseas and find an empire. And, you know, eventually, I think if you go back to our episodes on like mercantilism and the economy, you know, economies of like early America and Europe, we talk about it a little bit, but that's kind of where they got this from. They went and found new lands. And it's really one of the driving factors was the fall of Constantinople. It didn't necessarily start right there. Like that was the match point. That was just throwing gas on something that had already been kind of underway because there were sailors and explorers that had been pushing out. I think the Azores had been discovered. They had already been trying to navigate around Africa. So they just pushed out and found the new world.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of wild to think, and I don't know if I've ever thought about it in this way before, but the very event where the capital of the Western world fell is what caused later, like hundreds of years later, it caused the, not the event, but like the idea, colonialism, right? This exploration and colonialism. It caused the very thing that made Europe the global powerhouse for the next several hundred years, right? Like even today, you know, the United States is the singular exception, but like you remove the United States, like Europe is still the world's like powerhouse. And obviously, you know, well, now that I say that out loud, you look at just in terms of GDP, China's number two, Japan's number three. You're like, oh, and I think number four is Germany. It's either UK or the German or Germany. Like on the whole though, like the entire continent of Europe is far and away. Like we can't even here in the United States say, I mean, what other continent across the board has a level of affluency than Europe, right? Where it, like there's no other continent that comes close, not even North America. It's kind of cheating when we just say the United States, but like, do you see what I'm saying? Like, it's like colonialism is what took Europe and just made it the global powerhouse. And colonialism all got started because Constantinople fell. You see what I'm saying? Like, there's that irony there.
All of these events are intertwined. I think that's the biggest point that we need to make is like none of this happens in a vacuum. I can't help but when I hear, I see the news, I see somebody talking about some historical event, they just look at it in a vacuum. Like this just happened. Why did X person behave like this? Why did, you know, we have all of this because of one singular event. In reality, it's historical inertia. I think that's the best way to think of this because like we mentioned, Constantinople didn't begin to fall in 1453 just because the Ottoman army showed up. Its fall had started hundreds of years prior.
Right.
And just like colonialism didn't just start with Christopher Columbus saying, hey, you know what? I just want to go, I just want to get in a boat and go see what I can find. Like, no, there was a reason behind that. That reason was kicked off decades prior. So like it all bleeds in together and it's very difficult for people to take a look at that inertia and that movement. It's people look at history like photographs, like, oh, snapshot. Here it is. Let me judge the snapshot. When in reality, you're watching a movie. You're watching a 8K video of real time past human events that we're trying to put together. And you can't do it by looking at a snapshot. That's why it's important to say, okay, well, why did Rome fall? These are the reasons. Oh, well, it kind of happened in Han China, and it kind of happened in the Byzantine Empire. What was the cause of this? Oh. The United States was discovered because Mehmed II was dead set on conquering Constantinople. That's a very gross oversimplification, but it's kind of not at the same time. Like, had he not taken that, it could have been another 50 or 100 years before North America was settled by Europeans and colonized, and history could have ended up very, very differently.
Yeah. And I don't remember if we talked about this in our last episode or not, but like there's also the Renaissance.
Oh,
like the Renaissance was very much driven by, in part, the fall of Constantinople. It started before, but it started before because there were these rising Arabic speaking powers that had preserved a lot of the original Greek and Latin documents. And that as these Arabic powers rose, they started sharing this information with Europe. And then when Constantinople fell, a lot of those documents, like a lot of the Byzantine brain drain, like came and moved into Europe.
Rome.
I mean, and not just the Renaissance, but the Protestant Reformation as well. That's a whole other thing.
Jay, it's almost like we've been doing this a while. That was point number three that I was going to bring up here and talk about is the knowledge transfer. So again, the Renaissance, the Reformation, those events were already beginning to occur. Kind of with the Crusades, a lot of these Italian cities were becoming much wealthier, ferrying crusaders across the Mediterranean. They were becoming wealthy. Well, what do we want to do? I've got a pet project. I want to build a church. I need to get somebody who's artistic to build this. So these things had already started happening, but there was a Greek diaspora that began occurring right before Constantinople fell, and definitely right as it fell, and some of the other areas around Greece were taken over. And they fled to Italy and other parts of Europe. But when that diaspora came, that's when, to your point, these preserved works, they started looking back at the classics. So that it wasn't just that they're, hey, I want great artwork. It's, hey, I want to look back and study these things that Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, I want to learn about these things. This is how I want to learn. And I need, oh, and by the way, now we have somebody who can translate the New Testament from Greek to German, to Italian, right, to English, not necessarily from Latin to English. Oh, and by the way, in the 1450s, I think it was 1455, actually, Johann Gutenberg's printing press came out. So now everyone can have this translated Bible, and everyone, you know, so you have these events that kind of fuel each other. But that's one of the other byproducts of Constantinople falling. It's like, well, this knowledge that was kind of trapped in, yeah, and I say trapped, but it was kind of penned in with Constantinople. Well, it was almost like as soon as that was, it was pruned and went somewhere else, it grew into it blossomed somewhere else.
Yeah, it's, I'm reminded two things. The literal meaning of the word Renaissance is rebirth. And the motto of the Renaissance was back to the sources. And it's this whole idea of like, we're going to take the core of Western civilization, right? Like the Greco-Roman philosophy, authors, writings, these kinds of things. And we're really going to like not renew them, but bring them into the modern day. Yeah. We're going to take these, reinvigorate. Thank you. Refer back to a thing that you said in our first few episodes on the fall of Rome. It's like the preservation of fire, right? This, like, hey, we're going to take the old, the good parts of the old, and we're going to make something new out of it. Like, that's the heart and soul of the Renaissance. And it all happened because the Ottomans conquered Constantinople.
Right.
It's crazy. And
you could make an argument too. Like, that's, those tenets of the Renaissance are very similar to the Reformation and what the reformers wanted, but exclusive to the church. They said, okay, well, we want to look back to the early church. We need to get back to sola scriptura, you know, like scripture alone. Like, we want to get back to that. Now we have the original translations. We have all of these great thinkers who can help us write and translate and spread the Reformation. So it was also a contributing factor there, and if you don't know much about European history, the Reformation was another seminal moment in Western history, because it divided a once united Catholic Church.
Yeah. For the Protestant Reformation, the impact that the Renaissance had on the Protestant Reformation was the rediscovery of the Greek New Testament. And Erasmus of Rotterdam, it's kind of funny, you know, we think of Martin Luther as the guy, you know, he nails his 95 theses on the door of the church in Wittenberg as the beginning of the Protestant Reformation, and that's true. But like, there's an argument to be made that Erasmus, who was the main guy that kind of compiled, I forget the name of what he called it, but he's the guy that compiled the Greek New Testament that everybody used. And it was from that Greek New Testament that people started translating in the Vulgate. You know, before then, the entire Roman Catholic Church used Jerome's Latin Vulgate, which is not a bad text. It's just a text, and it's not the original text, right? So when Erasmus, consolidates this Greek New Testament, hence, you know, again, Renaissance, back to the sources, that helped spurred on this Protestant Reformation. Was like, oh shoot, like I'm reading it now in my own language because it's been translated from the original text. And this as something different than what my bishop is telling me that it means. So just these tectonic movements in Western civilization are all because the capital of Western civilization fell.
Kind of wild to think about.
It is definitely wild to think about. I, you know, and kind of shifting gears to how this, like the implications for today, it's almost like, you know, I think we can sometimes be short-sighted as Westerners, as Americans, in thinking like, oh, what's bad for me is inherently bad for the world, which I think that's true in some senses, but that's not necessarily true in all senses, right? Like, I'm trying to think now off the top of my head, like, how is it actually good? Because in that sense, like, the fall of Constantinople was in fact a good thing, right? Like, good things came out of that, right? Is there any good things that come out of a Western decline? That's a hard question to answer as Westerners.
Yeah, because you can make the argument that Constantinople was a seat of the West, but it was no longer the seat of Western civilization anymore. Like, it was almost symbolic, kind of like how Rome had moved its capital to Ravenna, and Rome was just a city, just there. It was kind of the eternal city that was just there. Kind of like Constantinople. You could make that argument that it was everything that happened to it. A decline in Western civilization is bad because whether we like it or not, and people can agree with this or not, but Western civilization has been a net good for the world.
Yes.
And getting a decline in getting rid of Western civilization, which is some people's goal, is just objectively bad because A, you're getting rid of all the good that they did. B, it's like a very large portion of the population of the world's population holds true to Western civilization. So it'd almost be like me saying, well, hey, Eastern culture, and I say Eastern just as a kind of a catch-all, but like I want to get rid of it. Get rid of it. Like, hey, it should decline and evaporate. You're kind of saying like, hey, the way people live should be gone and it should be the way I want to live, right? So as a blanket statement saying like Western civilization, is there good out of it? No. The only good that would come is if there is kind of another renaissance, like a rebirth, like, okay.
Yeah. A new and better Western civilization.
Exactly. And I think that's the key that you'd have to look at is say like, okay, well, we don't want to worship these ashes of Western civilization and hold up these great things that they did. Yes, it's great. Let's take the good from that. Let's rebuild and reinvigorate, rebuild the fire, the flame, right?
Yeah, I think we could, you know, we could probably have a very robust discussion on trying to be as objective as we possibly can about is Western civilization better than non-Western civilization? And is it like, is a decline in Western civilization in terms of power, is that necessarily a bad thing? We could probably have a good conversation on all kinds of different metrics to try to quantify that, you know, give examples and yada, yada, yada. But the one thing that comes to mind right now where it's like, let's just take one thing, migration, right? We could try to come up with all these theoreticals about what's good, but let's just think to ourselves, where do people actually go? Where do people want to live? Where do people want to be, right? And the last I checked, it is like an overwhelming migration is from non-Western to Western, not the other way around. And it has been that way for like, I don't know. I don't want to say the wrong thing, but it's been that way a really long time. Like, at least here in the United States, our migration for the last 150 years has been insane. Like we are the third most populous country on the face of the planet. And it's because of migration. You know, we were nothing but like a tribal backwater, globally speaking, for the vast majority of world history, and just in the last, you know, 150, 200 years, we are only surpassed in population by India and China.
Two ancient civilizations, very ancient.
Right. So it's just like, and it's like, oh, you know, the United States is huge. It's got to be a big population. It's like, no, look at Russia. Russia is by far the largest country in the world. And it's like 13th in terms of population. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to live in Siberia. You look at the United States, like, you know, for our non-American listeners, like we call it, and this is a friend, a term of endearment. We call the middle of the United States flyover country because not a lot of people live there. Like the vast majority of the American population is on the East Coast in California.
Yeah.
Texas is massive. So like in terms of numbers, like a lot of people live in Texas, but Texas is a huge state.
Well, even in Texas's case, a lot of people live within like 100 miles of the coast. Houston, Dallas.
Yeah.
All of those are not that far away from the coast.
From the Gulf, yeah.
From the Gulf, yeah. From the Gulf, which is still part of the ocean. So there you go. They still live on the coast. Nobody lives in North Texas or West Texas. I've driven through it like 5 or 6 times.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing out there.
It's pretty barren, for sure.
It's beautiful country, but it's emptiness.
Right. So that's to wrap up my point here. It's like, you know, again, you and I or a listener or two could argue until we're blue in the face on which is better, Western or non-Western culture. But the majority of people who have had the opportunity to move with their feet or on a plane or on a boat, they tend to move from non-Western to Western societies, not the other way around. And with that being said, I think that's a strong argument that Western culture at least has a better quality of life than non-Western culture, regardless of GDP.
Thank you for the disclaimer at the end.
Yeah. Hey, I have lived in Japan. Japan is fantastic. I've loved living in Japan. So that's like, I can simultaneously say, you know, be a champion for Western culture and be a huge fan of non-Western culture.
Well, you know, I think, oh boy, now we're getting off topic, but real quick, I think Japan and South Korea are probably, and even China, modern China to an extent, have hybridized, like they've kind of embraced Western ideals to a degree. Mm-hmm. Like a democracy, like it originated in Greece, but it's found its way over there. So, I mean,
yeah.
And I mean, cultural norms, like there's still this hybrid of like, yes, there's some very ancient Eastern cultural trends in society that they exist in, but it's not like Western, most Westernisms that you would think of or Western cultural trends, Western civilization aspects of that have made their way in. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. Some good, some bad, but
yeah.
The point is, it's even in those countries, Western civilization has made its mark in it.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I would say that those countries have embraced capitalism more than they've embraced democracy,
yeah, China in particular. The way to say it. Well, it's the People's Republic of China. I thought they have elections every, you know, every couple of years, right? They have a say.
But I mean, look at China's economy. China's economy exploded, and we are way off topic, but China's economy exploded when they started adopting a free, somewhat open market capitalism. It has since stagnated, especially since 2020. But even, you know, the rate of growth starting in 2012, when Xi Jinping took over, the rate of growth has arguably stagnated since then because they have reversed a lot of their, capitalistic type changes. So
you know what? That may not have happened had Constantinople fallen. Not fallen.
Which part?
China's GDP. They never would have had they never would have embraced capitalism had Constantinople not fallen.
Did you just connect a whole bunch of dots?
Yes. I made a massive leap in logic right there.
A massive, massive
just to connect what we're talking about to the actual episode.
Well, here's a counter argument. Would the century of humiliation had occurred had the age of exploration.
No, that's part of my leap. Those two things are very much part of my leap. Because then Mao wouldn't have taken over. He wouldn't have used that hurt, as we've talked about, that angst, the cultural angst and inertia, and taken power. And then if he hadn't taken power, eventually Xi Jinping wouldn't have taken power. That's why history is important to learn.
Some big leaps.
We don't have time to get into it.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, those are some leaps. Well, with that, I think we're at a good stopping point for this episode. Colin, I really enjoyed listening and learning from you about the Byzantine Empire. You're the smartest person on Rome and the Byzantines that I know, for sure. And it's been really good learning from you. Super excited to continue the series next week as we talk about the fall of the antebellum South. If you've liked what you've heard here, the best thing you can do is rate and review this podcast. 5 stars is greatly appreciated. Thank you so much to all those who have already done so. That goes a long way in helping get this podcast out to other people. So please give us the 5-star review. Leave us a comment so we can give you a shout out at our next episode. We also really enjoy feedback. We love hearing from our listeners. You can reach out to us on Instagram, X, Facebook, email, smoke signals. We appreciate all of it. No, if you do a smoke signal, we will not see it. And with that, thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you next week on The Loins of History.